Welcome to the Local Edition. News and information, we're keeping you connected in the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania. And we're continuing our look back on the year that was, and which implies a look ahead at the year that will be. And this week we're doing that, we're tackling different subject areas or different localities. And today's story is so big, we're going to devote the whole show to having a very long conversation about the year that was in terms of environmental issues, specifically climate change issues, specifically in New York State. And to help us do that, my guest for tonight's program, it's Lissa Harris, freelance climate reporter who writes for the Times Union and also publishes the Empire of Dirt newsletter, climate policy newsletter that Lissa puts out. And Lissa's on the phone with us right now. Lissa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I got to say, you know, say it up front, and I'll probably say it later, but thank you for staying on top of these issues that you know better than pretty much anybody else, that most of us aren't looking at it that closely. Like, even those of us who are concerned about the environment or concerned about climate change issues, there's just so much to it, and it doesn't really, the information doesn't always get to us, so it's real easy for us to overlook it, but you really look at this stuff.
Well, Jason, you know what? If I had a nickel for every time somebody asked me an innocent question about, you know, what's going on in climate, you know, and these are people who care. Like, I actually struggle to find people who don't care, even people who are cynical about all this stuff. You know, they care about what's going on. I think the overwhelming majority of the general public is like, yeah, climate change is happening and it's bad and I care about it. Like, this is a common ordinary perspective. But I don't blame anyone for not following the minutiae of it, because it's, you know, solving climate problems is a fiendishly complicated task. And it's complicated in a lot of dimensions. It's not just that climate science is complicated, but there's a lot of kind of technical complication in how you solve problems of stopping the burning of fossil fuels, which is what's really overwhelmingly driving climate change. And there's also, you know, incredible political complexity in, okay, once you figure out what you have to do, which is already complicated, how do you politically pull off doing it? It's just, it's so much, and you have to stay on top of so many different realms that, you know, once I started going down this rabbit hole of following what was happening with the effort to solve climate problems in New York State, which I was doing full time for the River Newsroom last year, and now that I branched out on my own, I'm like, I'm not gonna stop writing about this because I know too much and it's too interesting. So, you know, I branched out on my own, and now I'm writing for myself and for my readers on Empire of Dirt, which is my own newsletter that I run on Substack. I'm writing for the Times Union. I'm writing for the River, and I'm writing all over the place, but it's a lot to stay on top of. And I really am trying to stay on top of both the political aspects of this effort, as well as, you know, the engineering and the science and the local government efforts that are happening and the local business efforts that are happening to try to solve some of these climate problems. It's a lot.
And we'll mention it again at the end, but before we go any further, where do people find your Empire of Dirt newsletter?
You can find me at empireofdirt.substack.com. Mm-hmm. And I hope people do. Most of it is free, but if you send me $5 a month, you will get all of it.
You'll be able to keep doing that work. And
I will keep doing that work.
So, you know, I mean, we're told climate change, like you said, we walk around saying this climate change is like the one of the biggest issues of our time, the defining issue of our times. It doesn't always feel that way in either the news or in the places where policy or legislation are developed. But this year, 2022, in New York State, it seems to me that this was a year where these things really, it was a big year in climate in New York State,
it
right?
It was. It was a big year, and I think next year is going to be a bigger year, but we'll get to that. But yes, 2022 was a big year in terms of, you know, gears turning, things moving forward. You know, there's a lot happening on the state level about climate and climate problems and climate solutions that, you know, that most people aren't super aware of, because like you said, it does not dominate the headlines. This is slow, wonky policy work, and you know, it's not flashy, so it's tough to stay on top of.
And maybe let's start with something that and also we forget as time goes by, it's really easy to forget what happens. Let's start with one of the more recent things that actually did grab some headlines if people were looking, which is the Environmental Bond Act passing in New York State here towards the end of the year. What are your thoughts on that and the implications of that?
I think that what that means, you know, voters, New York State voters passed the Environmental Bond Act. They voted to, to put up a big chunk of money towards a bunch of different environmental projects. In the climate dimension, a lot of that money is going toward not necessarily, reducing emissions, but towards resilience, toward making local communities and our infrastructure and, our various important things that make things function around here resilient to climate disaster, which for us here in the rural Northeast mostly takes the form of flooding. So, a lot of that funding that voters voted to pass is going to go towards kind of fixing the problems that climate disaster causes in a physical way for communities. And you can kind of divide climate spending into two buckets. You've got the work of decarbonization of getting away from fossil fuels, which is trying to stave off worse problems in the future, and then you've got the work of resilience, which is trying to make climate disaster less painful for people, less destructive to our infrastructure and to our communities. So and the trouble is you really have to do both of those things at once, because even if you go as hard as you can on stopping the burning of fossil fuels, you are still going to have to deal with increasing climate disruption until we sort this all out, which is going to be decades. It's going to be a long time. So, that was a long preamble, but my thought about the Environmental Bond Act is that it's really interesting, really, really interesting to me that it was not a controversial vote. It was not a close vote. You know, this is a year where we saw in New York State a very, very tense, tight contest between Democrats and Republicans at the federal level in Congress, at the governor level. It was a fierce year, but none of that touched the Environmental Bond Act. People overwhelmingly voted for it. It was more popular than Kathy Hochul. Right. People want to fix things, even if they don't fully understand where that money is going, what it's going to be spent on, the dimensions of how the climate problems work and how you fix them, even if they don't have really a good understanding of all that, which is tough. They want to do something. They want to fix this stuff.
So this is great. What I'm hearing from you is that, like, above whatever good the actual people voting on the bond, whatever actual good that the bond does, is actually above that, there's the bigger good of you looking at this vote as a litmus, a measuring stick where New Yorkers are at in terms of their feelings and their willingness to tackle these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's a general sense that people have that maybe isn't quite on the money. You know, there's a general sense that people have that, like, you know, that climate change is a controversial issue. And, you know, there are definitely people who don't think it's happening or don't think it matters. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's true that there are those people, but like, I don't think that it's the issue that it was 10 or 15 years ago. I think it's becoming relatively uncontroversial to say, yeah, you know, the scientists that have spent their careers studying this stuff are, and who overwhelmingly are saying, you know, climate change is happening. It's bad. It's hitting our infrastructure. It's hitting our communities. It's actually killing people. Like now, you know, not in the future, like now. It's uncontroversial to say, yeah, that's happening and it's bad and we should probably do something about it.
Right.
But that hasn't translated into, you know, into the kind of, you know, political calculus of I'm going to vote for people who are doing something about this. And that's a more interesting question because I think there's a lot of reasons for that. But, you know, but people really are, you know, I think the majority of people, you know, no matter how they politically identify, are in the camp of, yeah, this stuff is happening and it's bad.
Well, speaking of politics, and we're gonna come back to politics a couple times, but the segue here is also the fact that the Inflation Reduction Act passed at the federal level, just the fact that it was named ultimately Inflation Reduction Act, that was a political reality right there just to get it passed.
It was.
I was wondering if you can give a similar preamble that kind of explains, puts that into context for us, and then maybe talk about what implications does that have for New York State?
I think we are going to be sorting out for a while exactly what impact the Inflation Reduction Act is going to have, but you know, and this is slightly outside my lane, you know, because I am, you know, mostly concerned with New York State. But I think the consensus from climate folks on the IRA is that it's going to be pretty transformational because what it does is it really shakes up the chessboard in terms of, you know, how the subsidies work. You know, there's a lot of subsidies for fossil fuel production and use and it's, you know, converting it into electricity. And there's all kinds of stuff in that realm that is kind of opaque to people. And what the IRA has done is, you know, not necessarily get rid of all that, but put a whole bunch of new pieces on the board in terms of, you know, subsidies and incentives for clean energy. And it's, you know, it's not so much like shutting down the fossil fuel infrastructure that we've got going, but just putting new energy into building alternatives. And, you know, some of that goes all the way down to the household level. There are huge incentives in the IRA that take effect in 2023 for electric vehicles, for people to put electric cold weather heat pumps in their houses, which, by the way, I have. We can talk about that, too, if you want. I just did that this March, and I am looking forward to see how they do in the 0-degree Christmas weather.
Wait, what kind of heat pump?
They're heat pumps. They run on electricity, and the way that heat pumps work, unlike regular electric heat, is they don't actually generate heat. They just move it around. They work sort of like your refrigerator, but they have an outside piece and an inside piece, and the outside piece concentrates and collects heat from the air even when it's super cold out, and it moves it along a loop of refrigerant to the inside piece, and it heats your house.
Okay, so it's almost, this is gross oversimplification, but it almost sounds like an air conditioner in reverse, like literally put in the window the back way.
Yeah. It is an air conditioner, and in the summer, it works in the other direction. They have a reversing valve that turns them into air conditioners in the summer, so it pumps heat out of your house instead of into it. And they're wildly efficient. They can reach, you know, efficiencies of 300-400%, which is not, you know, possible under the laws of physics for a fuel burner, which caps out in the high 90s.
Right.
So they're cheaper to run. They are expensive to install and cheap to run. And what the IRA does, the Inflation Reduction Act, is it put in a bunch of tax incentives for people to put these systems in to reduce the cost of, you know, of installing them, of doing a retrofit, which is not cheap. And also, even more generous incentives for installing them in low-income housing, which is, it's tough to, as you can imagine, make an argument to your landlord, like, oh, I, you should change out my heating system so that my heat bills will be lower. Usually, they don't really have an incentive to care. So there are big incentives in the IRA for individual homeowners and, car drivers to adopt clean technology. But there are also incentives for, bigger entities like rural electric co-ops got a huge, huge win in this. The biggest deal for rural electric co-ops since the New Deal to help them build out renewable energy and receive payments for that, which previously they had not been able to do because the incentives for renewable energy development are tax credits, and rural electric co-ops are nonprofits. And they don't pay federal taxes, so they didn't ever get access to, being on the same playing field as these private developers developing solar and wind and things like that. So now they're on the same playing field, and they're ecstatic about it.
That's great. We're going to take a quick break here. My guest is Lissa Harris, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of 2 Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
In public radio, we value our relationship with each and every one of our listeners. You listen to us, and we listen to you, too. So keep our connections strong. When you join those who donate to Radio Catskill, you'll power more of the news you trust and more of the music you enjoy. So add your voice and your gift before the year ends by donating at wjffradio.org. And thank you for being one of our valued listeners.
Welcome back to the Local Edition News and Information. We're keeping you connected in the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania. We're focusing on climate change in New York State and upstate New York in particular. And I want to share with you the words of somebody who's writing about the fact that there is a Climate Action Council in New York State. You may not be aware of it, but you will be after we complete this conversation. But one of the quotes I want to share with you goes like this. The gas industry in New York will fight decarbonization to the bitter end. In that fight, they will seize opportunities to play on deep public fears about change and uncertainty in a realm that's so technically challenging that most members of the public do not truly understand the issues involved or the solutions that exist to tackle very real problems created by the transition away from fossil fuels. And right now we're speaking to the author of those words in the most recent, as of this recording, most recent edition of Empire of Dirt, titled There Will Be Politics. The author is Lissa Harris, freelance climate reporter. Lissa, that part really stood out to me, that notion that there people have different interests that are at the table here, and like water getting into the cracks of rocks and freezing in the winter, like politics are going to get in and start dividing folks.
Oh, I love that metaphor. I might steal it from you.
Go for it.
Great.
Go for it.
It's so great. Yeah. Oh, this stuff is wild. And like, I don't know, for the past year and a half, more even, I guess the past 2 years, I just have spent so much time hollering at people going, did you know that this stuff is happening? Because it's not a secret. It's the Climate Action Council's meetings have been public, and you can watch them live. You can watch them on YouTube. You can read their minutes. You can find all this stuff. It's on the state website, but it's so wonky that even reporters are not, delving into it too deeply. Their last meeting before the meeting where they took their big vote, which was Monday, The meeting before that, it was slated to be 4 hours, and it went over. They had to extend it. It's so tedious.
But just to make sure that
really important things are happening in all of this tedium. Really important things.
Well, the vote is, so is this, they voted on the plan for moving forward? Because I feel like in the past week you explained to me that there is a plan or most of a plan in New York State, but there are even questions over what the terms in the plans even mean.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's this plan that they just voted on Monday. So yes, New York State officially, finally has a plan for tackling climate problems. This is a process that got set in motion, about 3 years ago when New York State passed their climate law, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, or CLCPA. This is a realm stuffed with terrible acronyms, but the CLCPA was passed in 2019. It was a big deal. Everyone went, my God, this is a big deal. It was a very nation-leading piece of legislation, basically committing New York State to very, very ambitious targets in the realm of greenhouse gas emissions reduction. And people rightly looked at it and said, this is the most ambitious thing in the nation. And then guess what happened? 2020 rolled around. I don't know. You remember anything happening in 2020?
Yes.
It was a little bit of a pandemic that kind of, sucked up everyone's attention. So we had, we had pandemic. We had the Cuomo Roadshow about pandemic, which I also covered. It was super, super unfun.
Yeah.
And then when that was all kind of winding down, we had the Cuomo Scandal Roadshow. We've had many other things that have dominated the news and the headlines since the CLCPA passed. But this whole time, this entire time, the Climate Action Council, which was created by the 2019 climate law, has been steadily at work. They released a draft plan last December, which I wrote about for the River Newsroom. And that plan actually got, I think Basil Sagos, the commissioner of the DEC, who's the co-chair of the Climate Action Council, said it got like about 35,000 public comments. There are a lot of people in the state of New York who've weighed in on this thing, and a lot more who don't know that it exists. But yeah, this plan has been the work of the Climate Action Council for the past 3 years. And that Climate Action Council is about a little more than half state agency heads. But the other members of the Climate Action Council are a really interesting bunch. They include people from the fossil fuel and utility world. They include community and environment advocates. They include scientists. They're an interesting bunch, and they have a lot of different interests at heart. And they've all contributed to this plan. They've all, argued and debated and collaborated and worked, on this incredibly intense effort of crafting a plan, kind of a roadmap, if you will, for how New York State is going to really get off fossil fuels almost entirely by 2050. Out of every aspect of the economy. So that includes the biggest problem in New York State, the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions, is not some tremendous industry. It's not some manufacturing concern. It's buildings. It is how we heat our buildings. A third of New York State's greenhouse gas emissions are from buildings. And then the next biggest thing is transportation. And that's mainly, driven by how people drive, how people use their own personal cars. So, there's a lot of work in here in terms of making it attractive and economical for people to make clean energy choices, and also to try to ensure that, when new buildings get built, when you buy a new car, that those things should be clean energy driven. So that's, it's a lot.
there are a number of things that this brings to mind, but I think, you mentioned Cuomo and the fact that we're talking about a council meeting at the state level that has multiple stakeholders at the table working in what seems to be good faith on coming up with solutions for a big problem and that this initiative started under the Cuomo administration. It just brings up to me memories of what happened was supposed to happen in every municipality across the state on a very different issue, which was policing and community relations in New York State. Every municipality is supposed to come up with a plan for essentially revitalizing policing in that municipality. And then afterwards, a majority of the stakeholders, at least in our area that I talked to, felt like that ultimately it was just for show and it didn't really add up to much significant change, if any. So on a scale of like 1 to 10, 1 being like what that process was as window dressing and 10 being like something's really going to get done here and it's going to be good, where does the Climate Action Council fit on that rating scale?
That is such a good question. And I will preface my answer by saying, if you ask different people, you will get different answers. Right. I definitely know some people who are like, this is an exercise for wasting the time of wonks and for getting people all excited about doing a whole bunch of work that isn't going to go anywhere. I know people who think that, who I respect. I disagree. I would give it about maybe a 7. Let's give it a 7. It is definitely not like, you know, this plan doesn't, it's not a law and it's not a regulation. It doesn't have legal force at this point. But I think that this, you know, this process, this document, whatever you want to call it, is important enough and is, you know, it has enough gravity and it has enough authority, especially in state agency world, that it is going to move things forward.
Another thing that you said in there is that, you know, the biggest source of greenhouse gases is A, buildings, and then B, transportation. We all utilize buildings and transportation, but my guess would be that the largest concentration of transportation and buildings in New York State would be in the New York metropolitan area.
Well, yes, although these are different problems, as you can imagine. They're different problems in New York City than they are upstate. But yeah, and I would say vastly more tilted towards buildings in New York City in particular. Because, you know, it's New York City has very good public transportation. They have systems that allow you to, you know, not have a personal car that you drive everywhere. And a lot of people, in fact, choose not to have a personal car that they drive everywhere in New York City because it's a pain.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are very different problems climate-wise in New York City than there are in the rest of the state. That becomes especially acute when you look at the electrical grid. New York City might as well be its own state or its own nation, really, with regard to the electrical grid. But, you know, and this plan, if you look at it, and it's a lot, it's, you know, 430 plus pages, but, you know, There are multiple ways that it really gets into the differences between the different problems that arise in tackling climate issues in dense urban areas versus in more rural areas, also in different climate zones, because some of New York State is incredibly cold, and that is not New York City's problem. But it is, to some extent, it's our problem, but really up in the Adirondacks and very northern New York, it's a different shape of problem. So, you know, people are already kind of grumbling that this is a one size fits all, but, you know, there is definitely an appreciation amongst climate policy folks that problems are different in different parts of New York State.
And again, to quote you to you from the beginning of your most recent newsletter on New York City, you say its electrical power system is something of an island, mostly cut off from the low carbon hydro nuclear power that provides most of the juice upstate and instead is powered almost entirely by natural gas. And that was a bit of an aha thing for me reading that. And but you say one of the other big developments in the past year in terms of climate change is something that addresses this, right?
Absolutely, yes. A big thing that happened in 2022 was two transmission lines that are going to bring power into New York City got approved by the Public Service Commission. It also, I want to throw a mention here to offshore wind. The biggest energy lease auction that the federal government has ever held, and this includes, you know, oil, gas, everything else, the biggest, like, money-wise auction was for offshore wind this year. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of offshore wind built that's going to flow into New York City as well. So that's let me just throw that out there. But the two transmission lines, you know, which were one of them is called the Clean Path, and that one runs from the edge of my own Delaware County. It's going to be an underground transmission line that's going to run into the city, and it's going to carry clean power, some of which is already built. You know, you have some hydropower upstate, but also it's going to be a line that new renewables built upstate can connect to. And so that's one of them. And that one was relatively uncontroversial. The other one is called Chippy, and it's going to run under the Hudson River for a long length of it, up all the way to Quebec in Canada. And it is going to bring Canadian hydropower into the city, which solves a lot of interesting problems, actually, if you have hydropower kind of there as a backup for intermittent renewables like wind and solar. You can almost use hydro as like a battery and you know, store power and then release it when it's when other things are low. So, you know, that is, it's an important piece. But, you know, the Chippy transmission line has been wildly controversial amongst environmentalists in upstate New York, amongst people who are otherwise, you know, extremely, you know, vocally on the side of climate action, have been not as much on Chippy. Chippy has divided the climate world pretty intensely in New York State, and that has been really, really interesting to watch. And I think we're going to see more of that because, frankly, you know, the traditional model for how you do environmentalism and had that had its birthplace in the Hudson Valley, really, has been all about fighting projects and saying no to development. And so much of what's coming and of how we solve climate problems involves building things. It involves building big things and, you know, having large projects that have trade-offs that you really have to wrestle with. It's like, yeah, this project is not going to be impact-free. It's going to do things. It's going to solve some problems, and it's going to create others, and we have to deal with that. And that's something that environmentalists and, you know, people in the climate world more broadly, because I think climate problems are bigger than, you know, just quote-unquote the environment. I think that's something that the environmental movement and, you know, locally and everywhere is really, really having to grapple with, and will only have to grapple with more as the incentives from the Inflation Reduction Act start to take effect, as we really start to get serious about the transition away from fossil fuels and towards clean energy. This is getting really interesting, and it's fertile ground for people like me, for reporters to get into it.
Absolutely. And yeah, there's that transition from being in opposition to having to actually work on solutions. And then within that, you're talking about solutions to very complicated issues with a lot of nuance, with a lot of different stakeholders involved. It's not going to be simple. And this is where I would say, going back to the theme of there will be politics and there will be some purposeful division going on, that I'd be wary of anybody trying to sell a very simple solution at this point.
I agree. And I think that climate problems are a real test of whether we can work with each other in good faith, in, you know, not just in government, but especially in government, whether that's local government or state government or the federal government. And, you know, because good faith work across different interests, different, you know, people with different constituencies, is so important. It's so, so important. And that's, you know, you might roll your eyes at that because this is, you know, so obviously a time of great division, and it's very easy for people to kind of attack each other with cheap talking points, attack each other with cheap, like, oh, you know, you're across the aisle from me, so, you know, I'm just going to, you know, dismiss everything that you have to say or that you want to do just out of hand. And there's so much of that. And it's painful. It's painful, not just in a national politics way, but in a personal way. Like we've all had this, I'm sure, within our families, you know, these divisions are painful. It's very, very hard to work in good faith with people you politically disagree with. I think climate problems are such a test of, can we do this stuff? Can we even begin to talk about this stuff? And I don't know. I'm a little bit of a Pollyanna sometimes. I at the local level, you see this stuff happening because, you know, at the local level, we all know each other and people frequently have to deal with each other kind of across the aisle, and it just feels different. And so, you know, that gives me a little bit of hope that maybe we can actually work on some of this stuff, because it's not clear cut, you know, that there are heroes and villains here. It's not clear cut exactly what we have to do. It's all hideously complicated. And, you know, if we do work with each other in good faith, there we stand to win big time, not just by fixing climate problems, which is huge, but, you know, there because climate problems are energy problems, and because energy touches everything, there are all sorts of opportunities to address, you know, historical inequities and to, you know, to create new economic opportunities for communities that have, you know, struggled to find them, and to train a workforce to tackle these problems and make sure that that workforce is well paid. And, you know, there's lots of stuff like that.
And underneath all of this, too, I would say, is the reality that these problems that hopefully we can get together on, we have to, because they're existential threats as well.
But we have to, and we will be forced to deal with them. You know, if we don't deal with them proactively and try to, like, lessen the blows of climate change, they will be visited upon us. There is no turning away from these problems. There is only, do we try to solve them now, or do we try to solve worse ones later?
Yeah. And the only other thing I would add to all this too is that it's not just people that we have to deal with. It's not just the institutions that people have set up that we have to deal with, but this is about human nature. This is about, you know, things that humanity has been dealing with from the beginning, about how do we plan for change? How do we react to change? How do we work together?
It's really
or not?
Hard for people to cooperate about future, you know, long-term planning type stuff. It's just really hard. You're absolutely right. You know, it's much, we see this with COVID too. It's so hard. It's so hard. You know, it's painful to watch as somebody who is, you know, who's naturally sort of wonky and inclined to, like, thinking about, you know, complicated problems and stuff long in the future. But it's, this stuff requires looking ahead and thinking about a little bit more than your own bare self-interest. And that stuff is hard for people to do. And I have compassion for people who find it hard.
I want to thank you for helping us both look ahead and look back. We finally reached that point that we knew would come where we've run out of time, and that point was about 9 minutes ago. So to hear the full version, to hear this full conversation, go to wjffradio.org. We'll post it there, and you get to hear whatever the other 8 minutes were that I had to cut out. But in the meantime, I want to thank so much Lissa Harris, freelance climate reporter. The Empire of Dirt is the newsletter, and you can find that at empireofdirt.substack.com. Lissa, thank you again for doing this work, and I wish you all the best in the year ahead.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me on. I'm always delighted to be here.
This is the Local Edition. News and information keeping you connected in Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania. Make sure you never miss any edition of the Local Edition. Sign up for our podcast wherever you get podcasts from. I'm Jason Dole. We'll do it again tomorrow.